We've been talking about the resurrection and, of course, the Gospels figure prominently in our understanding of the information about the resurrection. These were people who, at least half of them, were apostles. And so we know that they were with Jesus and they were eyewitnesses of the things that we'll be talking about tonight. Then there's Mark. Mark probably was in the city of Jerusalem during the time that Jesus was in the city of Jerusalem. I can't say that from biblical information, but from the extra biblical information that it talks about Mark, the author of that gospel. He probably was in Jerusalem. He wasn't an apostle, but he was a disciple, it is said, of Peter. And so probably witnessed some of these things. Some of these things he learned about from Peter, but he is, let's say Mark is a semi-eyewitness. John, the last gospel, is not written by an eyewitness of these things, but John sets out, he says, in order the things that he had learned. And because of John's long association with the apostles, he hears about the things that Jesus said. So, Luke. So even though he's not an apostle, Luke does write as a faithful recorder of the things that had been said. So we have two apostles, Matthew and John. We have Mark, who was not an apostle, but was probably in Jerusalem. And then we have Luke, who later on puts these things down. Well, he tells Theophilus, he's setting them out in order. So we have a lot of information that's included in the Gospels about the resurrection, and we'll be talking about some of that tonight. If we can't get through all of it, tonight we're going to focus on the things that Jesus said that are recorded in the Gospels, and then later we'll talk about the things that happen on Resurrection Sunday, because those are recorded for us in the Gospels, and we'll spend at least the next couple of weeks looking at the information that we can learn about the resurrection from the Gospels. So let's begin. The first place I'd like to look is in Mark, the 12th chapter, and at verse 40. Now, this is the first statement, I think, that Jesus makes about the fact that he's going to be raised after 3 days. Mark 12, at verse 40, it said that Jesus is, Matthew, the 12th chapter, in verse 40. And I'm reading from the Holman Christian Standard Bible. I'm choosing to read from that one because it's the biggest print Bible that I have. And that makes it easier for me. Just as Jonah, Jesus says, was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. He's talking to the Jews. They've asked him for a sign. And he talks about the sign of Jonah. So from this passage, we can conclude that Jesus knew that the resurrection, that his death was coming. He also knew that the resurrection was coming. Now, that's his personal resurrection, okay? What we've said is that Jesus is the first fruits, and then we are going to follow after him. The next place to look is in Matthew, the 17th chapter. And we'll begin reading in Matthew 17 at verse 1. And we'll read down through verse 12. Can somebody, would somebody like to read Matthew 17, 1 through 12? Go ahead, Carol.
And 6 days later, Jesus took him, Peter, and James, and John, his brother, and brought them up to a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his garments became white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. And Peter answered and said to Jesus, Lord, is it good for us to be here? If you wish, I will make three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud saying, this is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Hear him. And when the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were very much afraid. And Jesus came to them and touched them and said, arise and do not be afraid. And lifting up their eyes, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. And as they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man has risen from the dead. And his disciples asked him, saying, why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? And he answered and says, Elijah is coming and will restore all things. But I say to you that Elijah already came, and they did not recognize him, and they did to him whatever they wished. So also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands.
Okay. So we've got Jesus appearing with Moses and Elijah. What does that tell us?
Well, Moses and Elijah were the two people that, besides Abraham, that the Jewish people looked up to and put above as their guide. And they see Jesus is also in this, and then they're corrected by God himself that you need to hear Jesus and not only Moses and Elijah. He's most important.
Okay. Yeah, Bill.
It shows that they're still alive ages after they died.
Okay. Moses and Elijah have been dead for a long time, right? And the Jews know that. There's no question. They know that Moses and Elijah are dead. Now, there's a little bit of confusion later when Jesus talks to the disciples and they ask him a question. They said, before the Son of Man comes, Elijah has to come. Okay? And so there's a little bit of confusion going on in the minds of the apostles. And Jesus said, Elijah came. Who's he talking about when he talks about Elijah in the end of this reading?
John the Baptist.
Okay? He came in the spirit of Elijah. He was doing the work that Elijah was doing. And he's come already. Now, John the Baptist is dead. Herod's already killed him. Okay? But at this point, what we know is that Moses and Elijah, even though they've been dead for a long time, they continued to exist. Yes?
The last part of this reading is a little confusing to me, because it says Elijah will come and restore all things, future tense.
Well, that was the statement that was made about Elijah, that he would come and restore all things. And he did. He came and he prepared the way for the Messiah. Okay? So Jesus is quoting a statement that was made about Elijah, about John the Baptist.
So this is actually speaking about the past instead of the future.
He's talking about the past. Elijah was going to come, restore all things. That was John the Baptist. He's quoting the statement that was made about John. Yeah, Tim.
I think it was in Malachi 4 and verse 5.
Okay. Okay. So at this point, is this an indication, because Moses and Elijah appeared, is this an indication that the resurrection that we're looking for has already happened?
No.
Not all people have come forth from the grave at this point. So Jesus hasn't been killed. He hasn't been raised from the dead as the first fruits. Moses and Elijah are dead, but they're appearing. So in between the time that a man dies and is buried and his body returns to the dust, and the time in the future when all men are raised and go to judgment, there is an existence. That's the time period or the state that Moses and Elijah represent. Okay? I don't know what their form was. I just don't know. They don't have that body that God prepared that we talked about last week in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58, when we receive a new body. They don't have that one yet. They've got something. They have a form, and the apostles were able to recognize them as Moses and Elijah, but I just don't know anything about that form. Ted.
I would also say that Jesus didn't have that body yet either, because Jesus also did not have his resurrected body yet either. So
that's true. Of course, Jesus hasn't been killed. We don't expect Jesus to have his resurrected body yet.
Right.
This is Jesus, but his form changed.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that when God spoke that the men who were brought there as witnesses were on the ground for fear. And if I think back to when God spoke on the mountain, when Moses was there, all they heard was thunder and lightning. They couldn't understand. And so we have a tendency to put God into little boxes. Well, God can only do this. Well, God said this. He can't do that. Well, God can do whatever he wants. And if he wanted to be sitting up there with Moses and Elijah transformed, he could have done it. I mean, who was it that he took up in the...
It's possible that in order for everybody to see Moses and Elijah, that God gave them their body early. I just don't know. But here's the point that I'm trying to make. The fact that Moses and Elijah were recognizable doesn't say anything about the body that we're going to get. Because the resurrection, the big R resurrection for all of us, that hasn't happened yet. So they're in that temporary state. In Hebrew thought, it was called the state of disembodied spirits. I don't like that phrase because these were not disembodied. But whatever body they had, I don't know what it was. Just in the same way, I don't know what Jesus looked like here. Yeah, I'm fond of saying that what happened in the transfiguration was Jesus turned his wick all the way back up, and he just appeared as if he was God. That's the way that I think about it. In order for Jesus to come here and to be with us, he had to turn his wick, his light. He had to turn his wick way down so he didn't overpower everybody. And here in the Transfiguration, for just a few minutes, he turned his wick all the way up, and people were overwhelmed by it, and then he turned it back down. Okay? That's the way I think of it. There's nothing that tells me that that's specifically what happened. Yeah, Carol.
Isn't that what some of the people object to? They say that Jesus couldn't be God because people couldn't see God. Yeah. And so that's a great analogy of God being able to, again, limiting God as to what he can and can't do.
Yeah. I think if you saw God, you'd be overwhelmed. And so in order to be with us, Jesus had to turn it down. That's my way of thinking about it. Bill.
I think it's apparent that Moses and Elijah weren't just ghosts, because Peter wanted to make booths for them that were like solid beings. That's what was apparent to him. A ghost doesn't need a tabernacle.
Yeah. Good point. Why do you think Jesus said, "Don't tell anybody about this until I'm raised from the dead"? My first thought would be, I can't wait to get down off this mountain and tell people what I saw. Okay. Anybody else find that strange that Jesus said, "Don't tell anybody about this until I'm raised from the dead"? I don't know why he said that. It strikes me that he did. Yes. Carol.
Well, it seems to me the only thing I can think of that sounds reasonable is Satan thought he was going to win when he put him in the grave. So if the Jesus's prediction that Moses and Elijah are prophesizing that he's going to raise or be resurrected is not something that maybe that you want out there, but that's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah, Ted.
So maybe it's because when Jesus was raised from the dead, there's a much larger pool of witnesses to see that. And with these three people seeing them, that may hurt their credibility when they start talking about, you know, these things that happened when no one else was around. But once hundreds of people see Jesus raised from the dead, the credibility for the apostles having seen this goes way up.
Yeah, if all is in God's plan, I like Ted said, maybe he's preparing to wait until 500 people can see him at one time, and that makes it easier. Don't know. Yeah, Bill.
I wonder if it's possible that even in that day, people would think you were nuts if you talked about seeing people who were dead, and it would discredit them.
True. So, I don't know what the reason is. I am shocked that he said, "Don't tell anybody about it." Because my first thought, I've been like Peter. We need to build three tabernacles. And of course, God said no. That's the wrong thinking. And then I thought, I've got to go down and tell people about this. And maybe that's the wrong thinking. because people had to know that Jesus was going to be killed. And if you know that that's a temporary thing before it happens, maybe you discount the fact that he died. I just don't know. So we'll just have to leave it at that. But it is surprising.
Dean?
Yeah.
George had a comment.
Go ahead.
Well, this might be wrong, but now Jesus says to tell people who he is, and we don't. So if he tells people don't tell me, no, they will.
Yeah.
Good point. Yeah, Carol.
Well, and even though Jesus had told them over and over and over again that he was going to die, they still didn't really comprehend that. So this is sort of a quandary between what some of the apostles know and some of the apostles have been told that don't really know yet.
Okay. Good point. Now let's look at Matthew 25. This is a statement that Jesus makes that I think deals more with the judgment. And of course, that's one of the themes that we've seen consistently as we've looked at the information about the resurrection, that it's associated with Jesus' second coming. But, well, let's just read Matthew 25, beginning at verse 31, and we'll read down through verse 46. Can I get somebody to read that?
But when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them from one another, as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. Naked, you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. In prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? And when did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? The king will answer and say to them, truly, I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. Then he will depart. Then he will also say on those to his left, depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they themselves will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not take care of you? Then he will answer them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did not do it to the least of these, you did not do it to me. These will go away into eternal punishment, righteous into eternal life.
Okay. Is this after the resurrection of all people?
No.
Yeah, this is the discussion is before that happens, but is he depicting something that happens after all people have been raised?
His reaction at the end.
Yeah, this is all of us are raised and we appear before the judgment seat of Christ. This is when all nations have been raised. Everybody. Okay? So this is not during that waiting period between death and resurrection. This is something after the resurrection. Okay? Now, I stress that because it's important to think about judgment as the sentencing. Remember the rich man and Lazarus? Well, let's just read about the rich man and Lazarus. And we'll continue to understand more about this concept. Let's look at Luke, the 16th chapter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Carol.
Before you get away from this one, verse 40, and the king answered him and said to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did this to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. Is that specific brothers of mine, fellow Christians? Or is it all of mankind?
And his brothers.
My understanding of that is that it's all of mankind, but Jesus identifies with the Christians in a special way. Remember the statement that he made to Paul, why are you persecuting me? And Paul wasn't persecuting everybody, he was just persecuting Christians. So Jesus has a special affinity for those people that are Christians, a special connection. But he has a connection with all of mankind as well.
Yes, but the particular charge here is that you didn't take care of the body.
Yeah.
In other places, he tells us to take care of the world and strangers and whatever. But this, I think, is a particular charge against the fact that you knew this, that person needed something and you didn't do it.
But this is a statement this is a charge that's laid against everybody that's going to eternal damnation. This is not a charge that's laid against Christians. This is a charge that's laid against everybody who did not treat mankind well. Okay? So I agree with you. Christians have a special responsibility to minister to those that are Christians. They have a responsibility to minister to the culture at large, but a special responsibility to minister to those that are Christians. These people who are hearing this, some of them may have been Christians, but the people to whom this is directed were not Christians. Okay? So that's what makes me think that this is a statement that's made about the way that they have treated people, not specifically Christians. Okay? Because when he talks to the Christians later, those that are going to eternal reward, then they say, when did we see you naked or thirsty or anything like that? Well, they had done it to those that were his brethren. Okay?
Can I say something?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think we need to be kind of cautious here because there aren't Christians at this point. Christians were not referred to as Christians until the formation of the church in Antioch. And this is after Christ's death. So he's addressing followers and people who are listening to him here. But I don't think he's talking up and making a distinction between people who identify with him and not. These are the dead of all nations. And I think it's talking when he says, my brothers, he's relating himself to all mankind.
Okay.
There aren't Christians at this point.
You're right about, I shouldn't use the word Christian because it wasn't a term that would have been used at this point.
No, the disciples or followers or.
I shouldn't use the word disciples. Good point.
Right, right. Good point. But I think that we have to be careful that, I mean, the church has not been formed yet. There are not Christians yet. He has not been resurrected yet. All of that happens later.
Yeah. Very good point. So I think in general, this is a statement that Jesus makes about the way that we treat people.
Okay. I I think that's what it's saying. It's not specific to his followers.
Yeah. Yeah, right. It's not specific to his followers. Okay. So let's drop down and let's look at the rich man and Lazarus. The rich man and Lazarus is in Luke, the 16th chapter. This is a passage that we're familiar with. And there's some question about whether or not this is describing events that actually take place, or whether this is an illustrative story. It really doesn't matter, because the point that I see in it doesn't depend on that. So let's look at Luke 16, and we'll start in verse 19. And somebody want to read that? We'll read 19 through 31.
There was a rich man who had dressed in purple and fine linen, feasting lavishly every day. But a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, was left at his gate. He longed to be filled with what fell from the rich man's table, but instead the dogs would come and lick his sores. One day, the poor man died and was carried away by the angels at Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. And being in torment in Hades, he looked up and saw Abraham a long way off, with Lazarus at his side. Father Abraham, he called out, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this flame. Son, said Abraham, remember that during your life you received your good things, just as Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here while you are in agony. Besides all this, a great chasm has been fixed between us and you, so that those who want to pass over from here to you cannot, neither can those from there cross over to us. Father, he said, and I beg you to send him to my father's house, because I have five brothers with him, to warn them. They will also want to come to this place of torment. But Abraham said, they have Moses and the prophets, they should listen to them. No, Father Abraham, he said, but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent. They told them, if they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not rise from the dead.
So, when do you perceive this as a description of the state of people? Is this the state of people after the final big R resurrection? Or is it the state that people find themselves in after death and before the resurrection, in that period that exists between death and the resurrection? What do you see here?
I think it must be before the big R, because he wants him to go back to his brothers, and his brothers are still on earth.
Okay. Good point. Good point. This is not final resurrection, because his brothers are still alive. And if we're talking about big R, that's a funny way to describe it, but it works. If we're talking about big R resurrection, is anybody still alive at that point? No. Those that were alive have been changed, and they'll go to the resurrection. Okay? So we're talking about this in-between state. Is there still, in this in-between state, a sense of reward and punishment?
Yes, there appears to be some type of judgment. He was in torment. The rich man was in torment. He was in Hades, which appears to be some type of a almost like a holding place before the final judgment. and he was in torment. And it's interesting that it's almost like it's a final judgment, because you can't pass from that to another state, to another place. So, okay. So when the righteous die, where do they go? I mean, we know that maybe in the bosom of Abraham, which is where Lazarus went, and from afar off, the rich man could see him, but the rich man was definitely suffering some type of judgment, and Lazarus was experiencing some type of reward.
Okay.
Dean, maybe the purpose of this story is just to explain to us that death is final, that you can't go back and fix things after you're dead.
Okay. Now, that's a good point. Hang on to that for just a minute. We're going to come back to it. But there is a sense in which there's reward and punishment, even in this waiting period. Okay. And I like to think of the big R and the big J judgment as being when the sentence is finally pronounced. At death, it's determined whether you were guilty or innocent. It's just think of it in the legal system. At some point, it's determined whether you're guilty or innocent. That's probably during your trial. And then later, you go back before the judge and he pronounces the final judgment. Okay? This is the final declaration that you're going to be in heaven or in hell. But you already knew that. Nobody dies and goes to torment and then later goes to heaven. Just like nobody dies and goes to blessing and then later has to go to torment or later has to go to hell. Yeah, Lenny.
You can't change your situation once you die.
That's right.
We have to live a Christian life here in order to receive grace and mercy from God. And when someone dies in a sinful condition, they know they're going to be lost eternally.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, Carol.
Well, whatever form they were in, Lazarus and the rich man and Abraham's bosom, they could all tell that that's who they were. So how would somebody centuries away from Moses know what Moses looked like? Somehow it transmits and the whatever is the appearance. So it's not just for Moses and Elijah, but it's also for those others.
That's true.
Looks like.
That's true. Does it mean that they had a physical tongue? No, I don't think that's the point. That's not the point of the story. They existed in this state. Yeah, Bill.
There's a place in here where it says, now we have faith, hope, and love, but then we will have only love because the others will have been realized. This rich man still had desperate hope for his brothers. So the end had not come yet.
I'd have to think about whether we ought to put those two statements together. That's an interesting observation, but I just don't know if those two statements ought to be contextually combined, because they appear in totally different contexts, and that may be taking one statement from one context and putting it into another, and they don't. That we shouldn't do that. Yes.
Well, Jesus said that he was the way, and no man comes to the Father but by him. So that's the final determination.
did we give our lives to the Lord, and were we saved?
Okay. Good statement. Good point. You can't change after this. Now, the other statement that I want to see here, it builds on what you were saying. They have Moses and the prophets. I've already explained to them what I expected. They didn't listen then. They're not going to listen now. It wouldn't make any difference if one came back from the dead. And I've often thought, you know, I wish that I could see miracles like the apostles did. I wish I could see miracles like the early Christians did. And it wouldn't make any difference. If I listened now, I would have listened then. And if I don't listen now, I wouldn't have listened then. That's a statement that kind of occurs to me, because typically when you talk to people about living when the apostles did, wouldn't it be great to live when the apostles did? Wouldn't it be great if we still had an apostle? No, wouldn't make any difference. It wouldn't make any difference. Wouldn't it be great if we still had miracles? No. It won't make any difference. Yeah, Bob.
Well, I've just been thinking along with you on this. And the audience here is made up of a lot of Pharisees, and they're scoffing Jesus. And then we go down and read verse 31, and he tells these Pharisees that they will not be persuaded, even if someone rises from the dead. Guess who is going to rise from the dead? Mm-hmm. And they will continue to scoff and make us believe that.
Good point. Good point. With that point, let's conclude tonight. Next week, we'll talk about what actually happened on Resurrection Sunday. And, you know, when you get to the information about the resurrection from the Gospels, that's really what you're looking at, is what happened on Resurrection Sunday. Why was that such an important event, and what led up to it, and what really transpired? Any final comments before we close this discussion? Well, like I said, this is just, it's important stuff. This is what our faith is based on. This is everything that there is right here in a nutshell. Did Jesus come back from the dead? If he didn't, he was just a Galilean that was crucified. If he did, that means that he is God. And because he is God, he has the right to expect from us what he demands in obedience. If you want to put him on, you want to make him yours, you're going to have to do that with baptism. It's the only way to accomplish that. You can't say, I want Jesus to be my Lord, and refuse baptism.
Amen. That's right.
That's not possible. So if you want to put him on in baptism, we'll help you do that. And this is as much an encouragement to us to continue to live our lives the way that God expects us to live. That's what the Apostle Paul had been saying to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 15. We need to continue. And I know that sometimes that's hard. I know that we fail at continuing. But God has promised that he would forgive us. Confess your faults one to another. Pray one for another that you may be healed. James says, the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. So if there's something we can do to help you put on Jesus, or if there's something that we can do to help you to recover a faith that you may have lost, we want you to let us know.